Good morning and welcome back from the summer, from Rosh Hashanah, from Yom Kippur, from Sukkot. It's been a while, but it's good to be back. And Marjorie, thank you very much for inviting me. I hope this microphone is working okay. Okay, we're good. Okay, excellent. For those I don't know yet, I am Mordechai Korchiner. I am with the Yeshiva University Beit Midrash, a program that's based not too far from here, based in the high school at the corner of Fainwood and Almore, Yeshiva Or Chaim. And normally, our normal program includes programming for university students, local university students, and high school students, but I like to get around the community, and so I'm overjoyed to be able to be here. I feel a little bad given the announcement that was just made about Israel being the hub, but I did want to mention two other classes. I have a series starting at Beth Emeth, a week from Wednesday, Israel's Chief Rabbis, a three-part mini-series. The first one will be Rabbi Ovadia Yosef. We'll be talking about the balance in the role of Chief Rabbi between clergy and politician. And so that's starting on the 17th. And then on the 29th of October, starting a three-part series at Beth Tikva, Zionism, A-Zionism, and Anti-Zionism, the biblical roots of a modern conflict. So those are available. If anyone wants more information about them, you can email me. My email address is in the fine print at the top of the sheets, which I trust have been handed out. No, the sheets have not been handed out. Take that back. We can't have a class without paper. Okay. So I'm going to start us off while we wait for the paper to get here. They're not like on a chair somewhere, right?
The best chair for one is that on a Monday.
The Beth Tikva one is Monday, that's right. Yes. Beth Tikva is Monday, correct. Marjorie? Do we know where the sheets are? What am I missing? Oh, they're under Wisdom Abba. I see. Okay. Sorry. Wisdom Abba sign was covering it. Okay. Thank you so much. Okay. My fault.
Well, I can do okay. See if microphone is working.
Is it?
No.
Doesn't seem like it. No, I'm going to go with this one. Yeah, it is on, but it's not as good as this one. Okay, good. So I thought we would spend some time this morning talking about a midrash which I first heard as a little kid and did not understand. And I thought worth visiting as an adult. It is the story of Noah and the lion. And I tell the story this week because the weekly Torah portion for this Shabbat is, of course, the story of Noah. Noah, the boats, the animals, the flood, the rainbow, and the destruction of the world. Let's not forget that. The story of Noah and the lion. Has anyone heard before a story about Noah and the lion? Okay, I see one head nodding yes over here. A whole lot of no's. Okay. No, not Daniel and the lion. Right? There are multiple biblical lions. This is worth noting. Often they are unfriendly. You know, you have the story of Daniel and the lion, in which the lions were not supposed to be friendly, but they spared him. And then ate up the next meal offered to them, which were the Babylonians who had thrown Daniel in. You have lions as well with the Samaritans. If you move forward in Jewish history, the period of the Assyrian invasion, actually before the period of Daniel, when the Assyrians invaded the northern kingdom of Israel, and they exiled the Jews who had been living there, they moved in others they had conquered from other lands, and those became known as the Samaritans. And the Samaritans worshipped their gods, and they found themselves under attack by lions. And in fear, they turned to the Jews and said, well, what are we supposed to worship in this land? We must be punished because we're worshiping our gods, so let's learn about yours. And they became known as Gerei Arayot. They converted because of fear of lions. Jews, of course, will be subject to the same test by the Christians later on, right? That's a separate discussion. But no, this has nothing to do with Daniel's lions. This has nothing to do with the Samaritan's lions. This is just one lion. Because, of course, on the boat, there are only two, well, a lion and a lioness. That's correct. So, this story, then, is going to be new to some people here. And it's a strange story. And I want to spend some time talking about its origin, where it comes from, which is going to teach us a little bit about Midrash, what it is, and how it works. Because what we're going to find out is that Midrash is not simply nice stories. You know, whatever the rabbi quotes when he wants to tell a nice story in a speech. But Midrash is actually a rigorous intellectual approach to reading the text of the Torah. We'll spend some time on that. And then more on the content of the story and what it is that it's trying to teach us, and particularly about justice and kindness. So all of this from what is really a brief story. If you take a look at the sheet in front of you, you will see first source number one, and then number two. Source number one is a passage from the book of Mishlei, known in English as the book of Proverbs. Anyone here ever read Proverbs? It's not a book that gets read. For starters, it doesn't have a storyline. For the most part, it doesn't have a storyline. However, while it's true that it's not exactly a very popular work, it is quoted quite often because many of its lines are proverbs, adages that people are wont to say. Actually, Shakespeare ends up incorporating some of it. If you think of either a borrower or a lender be, that whole speech, right? So some of Proverbs makes it in there. But these are two lines from the book of Proverbs. The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life, and one who is wise takes souls. Yes, the righteous will be paid back in the land, also the wicked and the sinner. So let's just digest this a little bit. The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life. What does that mean?
Children, offspring.
Offspring, yeah.
A living person.
Sorry?
A living person.
A living person, meaning? What is it?
Like the tree of life.
The tree of life. Right, but the fruit, how is that the fruit of the righteous? The fruit of the righteous being children, I understand. It's some kind of a message of righteous people hopefully being able to produce children who will continue after them. I can understand that explanation. To have a good life. Meaning? The fruit of righteousness is that you have had a good life? Okay.
The good works and the things that they need for the future.
The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life, that which they produce for others. That's another way to take it. One more.
If you are righteous, then it gives you the possibility to be a tree of life, like getting more.
Right. And the tree of life for others, be a provider of life for others. Good. What we just heard are two different ways to take this sentence, and they're going to matter a great deal. The fruit of, in Hebrew, the fruit of the righteous is a tree of life. Pri tzadik, Eitz Chaim, is the Hebrew. The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life, meaning either it is a reward for the righteous, they get a tree of life, or the fruit of the righteous is a tree of life. They provide life for others. Both are legitimate reads. So that's something that's going to be important. And then one who is wise takes souls. That's a very hard turn of phrase. And that's one of those that's going to capture the attention of our Midrash. So I'm going to hold that for now. The second sentence, the righteous will be paid back in the land. The Hebrew for paid back is yishulam. Like the shalem, to pay. The righteous will be paid back in the land, also the wicked and the sinner. I heard a couple of mmms when I read that line initially. Is that a happy line or a sad line?
Happy.
What's that? What's the message here?
You get what you deserve.
You get what you deserve, right? Well, we pay back, you get what you deserve. So what kind of payback is it for the righteous then? Happy or sad? Reward or punishment? I would assume they're righteous, they're getting something good. So our midrash is going to surprise you on this one. But now let's get to the midrash itself. Take a look at source number 2. This is the midrash we're working with. It starts out by quoting a passage at the beginning of the Torah portion of Noach. Eleth holdom Noach. These are the generations of Noach. And then they quote you the passage we just read from Proverbs. Thus it is written in Proverbs, the fruit of righteous is a tree of the righteous, is a tree of life. What are the fruits of the righteous? Mitzvot and good deeds. So in other words, it's taking the explanation that the fruit of the righteous is the tree of life is what they do for others. It's not what they receive. If you're a righteous person, you produce benefit for the world. That's number one. And that gives us a definition of righteousness, of course. Right? Someone who's righteous is somebody who does good for the world, not somebody who's looking out for themselves. And one who is wise takes souls, for he fed and supported for all 12 months in the ark. Who is he?
Noah.
Now we have identified Noah as the target here. These are the generations of Noah. He is somebody who takes souls. He fed and he supported them for all 12 months in the ark. In other words, the image of taking souls is supporting life. That's the idea. Okay, then we get the story. And after all of this praise, the Midrash continues, commenting on that second verse from Proverbs about the righteous being paid back in the land. Yes, the righteous will be paid back in the land. He came to leave, he went to leave the boat, and was paid back. Paid back, the Midrash understands, in a negative way. This is remarkable, says the Midrash. What do you mean he was paid back? As Rav Huna said, citing Rabbi Eliezer, son of Rabbi Yossi Aglili, when Noah was leaving the ark, a lion bit him and broke his bones. Noah was now unsuited to bring offerings, korbanot, gifts to God, and his son Shem brought them in his place. I'm going to come back to that. And then how much more so, also the wicked and the sinner, the generation of the flood. Does this midrash make any sense to anybody? Do we understand what we're talking about? No. Good. It is good. Because I worked really hard to understand this midrash. And if I get this out and you said, oh, no problem, then I would just feel like, okay, I should go back home. This took a lot of work to break this down and understand what this was about. Our midrash is meant to be a commentary on the book of Proverbs. It shows up in Genesis Rabbah, which is a body of midrash on the book of Genesis. However, it's really a commentary on the verses in Proverbs, and it's trying to understand what their message is. That's what its goal is. So the midrash first asks a question. When you say the fruit of the righteous is a tree of life, it wants to know, what does that mean? And it could have been either the righteous receive a tree of life or the righteous provide a tree of life. And it, by connecting it to Noah and him supporting others, it's voting for the idea that the righteous are the ones who provide a tree of life for others. That's the connection to Noah, but I have a problem. The book of Proverbs, the book of Mishle, is credited to King Solomon. King Solomon lived about 3,000 years ago, a little less than that, by popular historical account. You got a good, 1,000 plus years from Noah's time until the time of King Solomon. What in the world tells you that the verses that we saw in source number 1 have anything to do with Noah? The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life. One who is wise takes souls. We have a lot of wise people in the Bible. The righteous will be paid back in the land. Okay. We have a lot of righteous people in the Bible. Why do you assume that's Noah? So I'll give you the answer on this one. Because it's not fair. It's not a fair question. The answer is, Midrash was written original Midrash was written by sages who had all of Tanakh in their heads at their disposal in a way that people normally don't memorize text today. They viewed it all as a single unit, and any piece of it could be commenting on any other piece of it without giving you a heads up, without giving you any kind of a warning. They see all of Tanakh as a single piece. And here, they say, the righteous, the word tzaddik, is used in very limited ways in the Torah. In the Chumash, the five books, the Pentateuch, how many people are identified as tzaddik, as righteous? Like I said, it's not a fair question. I have a computer, so I can search and come in with the answer. The answer is a number between 0 and 1, and it's not 0. Noah is the only person identified in the Chumash as tzaddik. There are other people who we use that term for in a popular way. Joseph, for example, gets identified that way. But in the biblical text, only one. And that is Noah. And so the Midrash looks at this verse in Proverbs and says, oh, you're talking about someone as tzaddik. Well, that's got to be Noah. Somehow or other, he's going to have to fit. That's number one. But number two, there's a second way you know it. Take a look at source number three. This is from the beginning of the Torah portion of Noah. I keep going back and forth between Noah and Noah, and I'm trusting people to know that it's the same person. Okay, but I should have said that a few minutes ago. And these are, well, there's a girl's name, Noah. So, you know, I don't want people to be confused. And these are the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, complete in his generations. Noah walked with God. And Noah produced three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yafet. The truth is, I should not have translated the word in the beginning, these are the generations of Noah. It's toldot, it's really descendants. That would have been the better translation. These are the descendants of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, complete in his generations. Noah walked with God. And Noah produced three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yafet. So since we have this beautiful white tree, for which I'm grateful, we should make use of it. Here's my problem. Here's what's bothering the Midrash. Okay. These... it's right there. These are the generations of Noah. That's how we start off. What should be the next words? Not what it says on your sheet. What should be the next words after these are the generations of Noah? Names, right? Shame. Right? Shame from whom we get Semites, right? Semites are descendants of Shem. Yes, Shem, Ham, and Yafet. Right? That's what it should have said. These are the generations of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Yafet. But it didn't do that. The text stuck something in the middle. Right? What did they say in the middle? He was righteous. He was perfect in his generations. He walked with God. Is that right? Perfect or complete? Either one is correct. Noah walked with God, and then we got Shem, Ham, and Yafet. Right? So the Midrash is bothered by this. This is why I get a little bit agitated when people say to me, I wrote a Midrash, or I created a Midrash. Like, it's hard to write a Midrash. You have to have an ear for language, like they did. The fact that they're able to read a verse that refers to a tzaddik and know before the ages CD-ROMs and Google searches and whatnot, that there only is one person identified as a tzaddik, and that's Noah, that's something that you have to be able to do that in order to generate a Midrash. Here, they catch this. These are the generations of Noah. He's righteous, perfect, walks with God. And by the way, he has these three boys. So they picked up on that, and they said, it's trying to teach me a lesson here. What lesson is the Torah teaching me? By saying, these are the generations of Noah. Noah was righteous, perfect in his generations, walked with God. So one way to read it is a not nice message about his voice. Right? He's great. We'll put that after. That's one way to look at it. What else did you draw from it, though? Yeah, Janice, you can
say. I was also going to say maybe they weren't as good as their dad.
Could be, but I think there's a more direct message coming here. Yeah. They meaning that they are the fruit of life.
Well, the tree of life.
So tree of life?
Because the fruit of the righteous is a tree of life.
Right. So you're looking at them. I'm looking at something more basic before we get to Proverbs. Yeah. What it's trying to teach me is that the true generations of Noah, the true descendants of Noah, really, I borrowed the word generations again, I should have said descendants. The true descendants of Noah are the fact that he was righteous. That's what it's trying to teach me. Eile toledot Noah. You want to know what Noah's toledot, what his product was? You want to know what Noah produced? It was righteousness. And by the way, he had kids. But the first piece is not his kids. This is important to me. In other words, when we value somebody, when we look at what somebody did, we look at the role that they played in the world around them. That's what our Midrash is doing. And so our Midrash says, you're telling me the tree of the fruit of the righteous, the tree of life, that refers to Noah, first of all, because he's the one who's called righteous. And second, because we emphasize his righteousness, what he did for others, the fact that he supports the world on the boat. That's what we look at when we try to decide what righteousness is really about. That's what our Midrash is trying to teach. The fruit of the righteous is not that he receives a tree of life. It's that he produces a tree of life. He provides bounty for others. So far, a nice positive message, yes?
I just thought what it teaches me then is that it's easy to have children. But it's not so easy to have righteousness.
Absolutely true, right? The parenting course, the registration, you know, none of that, right? You have kids and then hope. The righteousness is a lot harder. Yes.
Well, in other words, you're not defined by your children, even though you're very proud of your children. They are separate entities.
Right. Very true.
From your own.
Right. The definition of your value is not your kids. And therefore, don't put all of your hopes and dreams on them and give them a guilt trip for not living up to it, by the way. But absolutely, we are not defined by the generation we produce. Biologically, we are defined by the generation we produce with our deeds in this world, with the relationships that we have. That's the opening point of the Midrash. But I still have to explain the lion. What in the world is the lion doing in this picture? It was a nice story. It was a nice lesson. Where's the lion? So the Midrash is bothered here because of the parallel structure in the second verse from Proverbs. The righteous will be paid back in the land, also the wicked and the sinner. So I could read this and say, the righteous are paid back with nice things, and the wicked are paid back with not so nice things. But the Midrash doesn't like that. It reads it as parallel, and it says, being paid back must be a negative expression. That even the righteous are going to get zapped in this world. That's the way the Midrash reads it, and it assumes that this comes from Noah, because it's still his story, being bitten by a lion. How did you get there? What is that? So take a look at source number 4. After the flood is over, and he, God, destroyed all that lived upon the face of the land, from man to beast to crawling creature to bird of the heavens, they were destroyed from the earth, and only Noah and those with him in the boat remained. So far, so good. The Midrash picks up on the word only. and says only is an exclusionary word by definition, but only suggests that we want to take something out. You could have said, and Noah and all who were with him on the boat remained, and I would have understood it's just that, because you already said everything else is demolished. The word only, says the Midrash, is meant to say to me that even Noah was incomplete. Noah lost something as well. And so we have this idea that Noah emerged deficient by being big. Interesting. But why? What do you mean he was being paid back? What did he do wrong? Why should he get punished? So take a look at source number 5, which is another Midrash, which expands on it a little bit. Rabbi Levi said, for all 12 months that Noah was in the boat, he didn't sleep. Oh, you have all those animals there. Neither him nor his children, for they needed to feed the beasts. You had to get food. And some of them are nocturnal, some of them eat by day, some of them eat only at dusk. Rabbi Yochanan said, citing Rabbi Eliezer, son of Rabbi Yosef, with me once, Noah delayed feeding the lion. And the lion bit. I was hungry. And he left the boat limping. And that's the idea in source number 4, that it is only Noah. So now we have an added detail. It wasn't just Noah was leaving the boat, and then the lion bit him. Is he was late feeding the lion, and the lion remembered it. And at the end of the year, when it's no longer reliant on him, it says, payback time, and I'm going to bite Noah. And so we find in sentence, in source number 6, and this is the last bit of the origin piece of this Midrash, before we get to its ideas. The text, when Noah brings his offerings to God after the flood, says, and Noah built an altar to God, and he took from all the kosher beasts and from all the kosher birds, and he brought burnt offerings on the altar. Reading this straight, I would assume the pronoun he has the antecedent, Noah. That's a logical read. But the Midrash is saying, often biblically, we find an overuse of names, and really, it could have said, Noah built an altar to God. And Noah took from all the kosher beasts. And from the fact that it doesn't say his name again, maybe it's somebody else. It's his son, Shem, who is the righteous among the three, the most righteous among the three. He's the one who actually brought the offerings. Why him instead of Noah? Because Noah wasn't eligible. Okay, I've given you a lot to think about here in terms of the origin of this Midrash, and I recognize that there's a lot going on here. And I haven't explained all of it. For example, so fine, I understand he's deficient, I understand he got beaten, but where the lion? Why a lion, per se? And the answer to my mind is really as simple as, because what other creature is it that would have beaten him, that, you know, he would have emerged deficient from? It's clearly not, you know, rabbit. Lions are vicious creatures. Lions are dangerous creatures. Fill in the blank with the word lion. That's it. To me, that's what this sounds like.
Why would it say, and he left the boat limping, which means he was not anymore righteous?
Oh, no. He's still righteous. But he's still righteous, but he's ineligible to bring the offering, because to bring the offering to God, he has to be like an offering himself. He has to be whole.
So the limping has no meaning as some going back that he didn't hit the lion, and therefore...
So that's a good question, and that's part of where we're going with this. Thank you. There's a lot more to say in terms of the origin of this Midrash. Its lessons tie into other Midrashim. Shame of being the one who brought the offering is also significant, but I don't want to go there, because I want to get to the lessons of this Midrash and what we're supposed to take from it. Right now what we have is the following. First of all, the point that all of Tanakh, all of Scripture is taken as one piece, so that a verse in Proverbs can be seen as referencing a verse from the beginning of Genesis. The fact that Noah is the only one in the Chumash to be identified as a tzaddik, to have this term used for him, is important. Noah's product is a tree of life for the world, saving lives, but he is paid back for his failure in feeding the lion. Those are all lessons from this Midrash in terms of technique, if you will, of Midrash. But now let's talk about what it's trying to teach me here. What lessons Remember, Midrash is not there only, usually only, just to explain how to read a biblical text. It's not only about analyzing verbs in, you know, in Proverbs. There's something else here. It's also meant to teach us lessons for life. So what lessons for life are we supposed to get from this Midrash? I got three, Jen.
Nobody's perfect. He's righteous, but he's imperfect.
That he was imperfect, okay, right? He didn't succeed in feeding everybody on time. Okay. What else?
That caused pain.
That caused pain, meaning?
Oh,
that one should not cause pain, right? One of the lessons that's meant to be learned here is feed your animals. That's not a joke. Yes?
His leg wasn't perfect. Does that mean if you're crippled, your
cancer's
gone?
This is a very good question that I was hoping to duck. It's not our topic at all. It's a very important point. The question was asked, does this mean that if somebody is in some way physically deficient, now they can't serve God, they can't have a connection to God? In fact, if you open up the biblical text to Leviticus chapter 21 or so, you will find a list of what are called in Hebrew mumim. A mum is a physical defect, a blemish. And the rule is that the Kohen, the priest, is not allowed to serve if he has certain defects, if there are certain things that are visibly incomplete about him. Some of those are, you know, like if he's missing a limb. One of them is actually a unibrow, oddly. For those who are not it's not just a unibrow, it's more sophisticated than that, but don't worry about it. But what's the message that we're being sent? After all, the Chumash goes out of its way, and the Torah goes out of its way to tell us over and over not to be taken in by appearances. Repeatedly. You know, Samuel goes to coronate a king, and the firstborn comes out in front of him, and he is a fine, strapping young man, and he says, there he is. Neged Hashem Mishicho. Opposite God is his anointed one. God's anointed one is right here in front of me. And God whispers to him and says, you see only with your eyes. I see with the heart. And this one's not the one. You know, teaching us a lesson. Right? A lesson which is repeated over and over again in the Torah, as well as in rabbinic teachings, right? You probably heard some form of the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, which says, Al tistakel b'kankan, ela b'mashe yeshbo. Do not look at the bottle, look at what's inside. Right? Don't judge a book by its cover, but, you know, better tasting than the bottle. So the question is then, why are they disqualified from service? So one answer is that we view the Kohen and the priest as being like the offering itself. That was my point before. That just like the offering you give to God has to be whole, it's like you're saying to God, I'm giving you the priest, and I want to make a show of giving that which is complete. That's one answer that's offered. Another answer that's offered is that the concern is people's perception. Meaning, even though it's true that we all teach our children not to judge people by what they see, we also know what human nature is. And human nature is we're influenced by the visual. And so the concern is, somebody walks into the temple and sees the Kohen, who is in some way suffering like this, and says, you know, they either say consciously or subconsciously, I have a negative association with the temple. I don't want to be like that. That's something that makes me uncomfortable. So you don't want to create that situation. That's a second approach. A third approach, which I actually favor, is that we have various biblical predictions that in the time of the Messiah, God will heal all those who are broken. And the temple is meant to represent this era of the Messiah, this kind of Garden of Eden. And so everything is supposed to be complete there. But it's a very important question. especially in an age when we're trying to be more sensitive to issues like this, this would seem to be a problematic one. But let's go back to the feeding the animals, because this is actually really important. If you take a look at source number 7, also from Proverbs, a righteous person, note again, that's her righteous, knows the soul of his beast, and the mercy of the wicked is cruel. The idea that the mercy of the wicked is cruel is a separate discussion. You've probably heard it quoted in various contexts. It comes up in different contexts. But the definition of the righteous person is somebody who pays attention to the needs of the animals. This teaches us, this verse and many others, teach us a concept that's known as tsar ba'alei chayim, meaning the pain of living creatures. And we are taught, if you take a look at source number 8, there's a debate on this in the Talmud, the sage Rava concludes, the prohibition against paining animals is biblical. Meaning that it is a biblical prohibition against causing pain to an animal. And this comes up in a variety of ways in our literature. I brought you a number 9, I'm going to skip the note, but it's a source that is more contemporary that argues that indeed the prohibition against painting animals is a biblical prohibition. I think we once had, did we have a session once on vegetarianism here?
Yeah,
we did. So we talked about it then as a potential Jewish value. But it's not quite true that the Torah is always against painting animals. It's generally weighed against benefit. So in other words, where there is a benefit that's considered to deserve the price of causing pain to the animal, then the Torah will allow it. So take a look at source number 10 for an ideal example of this regarding getting a quill. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, author of the Ashkenazi portion of the Code of Jewish Law in the 16th century, said the following. For medical benefit, or other benefit, there is no problem of paining animals. Therefore, one may pluck a live goose's feather to use as a quill, without concern for paining animals. But he says, we don't do this, for it is cruel. Meaning, even if you have a justification, better to look for other ways. That's the message that he gives. The idea behind it is not simply that we don't want animals to feel pain. It's also that we don't want to be people who cause pain to others. We are taught to emulate God. And if you take a look on the sheet at number 11, we are taught God is good to all. His mercy is upon all of his creations. Yes? Right, so this is an important point in and of itself. The laws of kosher slaughter recognize this problem. You are probably familiar with the idea that if you look at the biblical text, it's fairly clear that human beings start out as vegetarian. Right? God does not license human beings to eat meat until after the flood. And why at that point is subject to great debate. Some commentators suggest it's because after the flood there's a diminution in human strength and there's a need for them to be able to support themselves with animal proteins. Others suggest that it's because the events that lead to the flood are people taking advantage of other people, stealing from others, kidnapping others, and so on. And God says, you know what, you need to be able to get your aggression out somehow, so I'm going to let you eat meat. That's another suggestion, yes.
There's no vegetation.
Right, there's no vegetation at that point. That's a fair point. There are also very few animals, you know. If you have hamburgers Tuesday night, you're not having them Wednesday night. But there's another element of it, which is elevating people's respect for human beings. In other words, if human and animal are treated the same, that could result in treating humans and animals really well. But it could also result in lowering the standard for the way you treat everybody. Right? I mean, it's well known, the number of people in the Nazi leadership who were vegetarian, they did not elevate their treatment of human beings. It brought the treatment of human beings down to the level of the treatment of the animals. So Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook wrote about this quite a bit. Yes?
Well,
question for the name.
Yes.
It says 16th century, and it says for medical benefits or other benefits, there is no problem of paying annuals.
Right.
Would that be right now? We don't agree with that. We don't pay animals. Actually, so we should make any experiments with animals that later on will need see benefits us. So
but we do. We test medicines on animals still.
So in that century, we already knew.
Oh, yeah.
We knew already that there is medical.
Oh, yeah. No, medicines have been tested on animals for a very long time. Keep in mind, the Greeks are already doing experiments. You know, Talmudic medicine rests on experiments. Yeah.
It does?
Yes. The idea of experimenting on, the knowledge of specific biological elements and which things are parallel and which are not between humans and animals grows more sophisticated over time. But experimenting on animals is a very old concept. Yes?
I just have a question about the sacrifice of animals.
Yeah. Good, so that's where I was going, and I got sidetracked, so I'm glad you brought me back to it. That was where I was going with the whole thing about vegetarianism. The human beings start out as vegetarian, and then as some form of concession, however one understands the philosophy of the concession, we are suddenly allowed to eat animals. However, post-Sinai, we are told again not to eat meat except in the context of an offering to God. And the Torah draws a very interesting distinction between meat that is brought in a korban, an offering to God, and what's called bisar ta'ava, meat of lust or meat of desire. And the latter category is viewed as degraded. And it's only when the Jews enter the land of Israel and they spread out and they live far from the central temple that they're told, okay, if you need to eat meat, and you're too far to bring a sacrifice, then here's the ritual that you will perform in order to eat meat. And it has the laws of Shemitah, which hasn't been pointed out, the knife having no flaw in it, no defect in it, the fact that the shofar has to do it all in one gesture, the fact that it cuts off the blood supply to the brain immediately. These are all steps that we are taught to diminish the pain that's brought to the animal. But I want to go back a step, because I skipped a step here, I realized, which is, so what about the sacrifices themselves? So there are many different schools of thought to explain the idea of animal sacrifice in the Torah. It's not a new problem. From the time of the Talmud 2,000 years ago, they were asking this question of what is this all about? And if you go back earlier to the prophets, you find them talking about people who bring sacrifices but are corrupt and hurt other people and so on. It says God isn't interested in that. So what does he want with the sacrifice at all? So I will mention one of the rationales because it fits particularly with the story of Noah, which is Noah goes into the boat to save the world. Why is the world going to be destroyed? What was it that led to the destruction of the world? We just mentioned it before. Not just poor behavior, a specific behavior. Specific type of corruption, not idolatry. Not that idolatry wasn't going on, that's not what God says. He says it specifically, Hamas. Hamas is the term used in the Torah, which is specifically use of violence against others in order to get what you want. I'm sorry, but that's what the word means. It is a form of theft in which one brings violence to bear against others, and the Torah describes it. It describes how the men were kidnapping women. That's what's going on in that era. But then after Noah comes out of the boat, God says, I'm never going to destroy the world again. What changed God's mind? So to make a long story short, the event that happens right before God says, I'm never going to destroy the world again, is when Noah brings sacrifices. What is it shown?
Long story short. Yes, definitely. Long story short.
Noah has shown that he can learn generosity. Because no one in human history has owned things the way that Noah owned everything on that boat. It only survived the flood because of him. in terms of his righteousness earning that whole survival of humanity. And number two, he fed everything for the year. So he owns it all. He gets off the boat, takes from the little that he has in this world, and says to God, I want to give this to you as a gift. Never mind that God doesn't need it. It's not the point. Whoops. Lost it this thing. Hello? Hello? Okay, here we go. I'm the most dramatic woman, too. Never mind that God doesn't need the animals. Noah is taking his most prized possession, his support, and saying, God, I want to give this to you. And God says, human beings who learn to be generous, there's still hope. And I'm never going to destroy the world again. And we find that play out because God says regarding Abraham and Sarah that he loves them because they're going to teach their descendants this specific behavior. God says, I love them because they are going to teach their children after them to perform tzedakah u'mishpat, righteousness and justice. That's what God values. And so the korban, the idea of the korban is not God needs my food. It's that I need to learn that generosity. That's a long story short. There's a lot more to be said about it. But going back to this business about kindness to animals, take a look at source number 13. It's a classic story from the Talmud. Regarding a man known as Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, he was the political and scholarly leader of the Jews, scholastic leader of the Jews, in the beginning of the 3rd century Common Era. He was our chief negotiator with Rome. He was a descendant of the Davidic dynasty. And he was also the leading scholar of the time. He was everything wrapped up in one, what the Talmud calls Ish HaEshkolot. He had everything all together. But look at the story about him. He was known for short as Rebbe, our master, because of his greatness in these different areas. A calf being brought for slaughter hid its head under Rebbe's garment. It was crying. Rebbe said, go, you were created for this. And in heaven they said, since he does not have mercy, let suffering befall him. And as the story plays out, I didn't bring you the whole, the middle part of it, he suffers from a terrible bowel syndrome. I've heard doctors try to compare it to various things. Today, it's not the point. He suffers from great pain for years until the second story. One day, Rebbe's maid was sweeping out the house. She swept out some rodents. Rebbe said to her, leave them be, for it is written, his mercy is upon all of his creations, right? The verse from source number 11. And in heaven they said, since he displayed mercy, we will have mercy upon him. Which is not just a lesson in kindness to animals, but it's a lesson using the leading figure of his day, the leading figure in the Talmud. Rebbe is the one who's in charge of the canonization of the Mishnah, the core text of Jewish law. They don't get any higher than him on the totem pole. And the lesson is that everyone needs to learn mercy. There's more to be said about it, but I'm going to cut to number 14, because that's the one that's most directly relevant. The Talmud teaches the following law. Rabbi Yehuda taught, citing Rab, one may not eat until he has first given food to his animal. It is written, this is in the section of Shema, I will put grass in your field for your animal, and then it says, and you shall eat and be sated. Right? First, grass for your animal, then eat and be full. But first, make sure the animal is taken care of. That's what our midrash about Noah is trying to teach. Animal first, then human being. So that, to me, is a very important lesson that we're getting here. There's more to be said about it. Number 15 is interesting. Number 16 is interesting. I'll come back to them at the end if we have a minute. But that's lesson number one. So here we have a midrash that picks up on dry, relatively dry notes within the text, like the use of the word tzaddik, right? Or the order of, these are Noah's products, righteousness and perfection, and his kids. it picks up on these relatively dry notes of the text and learns a lesson from them, which teaches us the importance of taking care of animals even before we take care of ourselves. But there's another lesson to be learned here, which is the attitude of a korban. We said that because Noah is now bitten by the lion, he's not able to bring the sacrifice. Now, we talked about that in general. But there's another piece here. Don't read it necessarily as he's incomplete, therefore he can't bring it. Read the whole chain. He delayed in feeding the lion, therefore he can't be the one to bring the offering to God. You follow? This is a very important point for us in terms of the biblical attitude to the korban. The korban is part of my relationship with God. What makes it desirable to God is the fact that I'm giving something that is meaningful to me. You know, when is the first sacrifice in the Torah? Cain and Abel, right. Cain and Abel. What did Cain bring? What was his gift? Cain. Cain brought? Plants. Cain brought plants. We don't know what kind of land. The text doesn't actually tell us. It says, pri ha'adama, fruit of the land. Abel, on the other hand, brought from the firstborn of his animals. And God prefers Abel's offering, and Cain gets angry, and you know the rest. Why does God prefer the offering from Abel? Cain brought the first one. Shouldn't he get credit for being first? So you could say, well, that just shows God likes animal offerings, but that's not true, because in fact we had vegetable offerings also in the temple. The first fruits are brought, grain offerings are brought. It's not a rejection of grain offerings. That's not it. And it isn't that God has to choose one and reject the other. God can accept both. So what's the story? Rabbi Jonathan Sacks said something brilliant. I would write it out on the board, but I think I'm running low on time. What he shows you is this. In the Hebrew, when Cain brings his offering, it says he brought meat pri ha'adama, from the fruit of the land. When Abel, Havel, brings his offering, it says he brings meat b'chorot sono, from the first of his animals. In other words, Cain brings that which he finds around. Abel brings from that which is his, that which he has nurtured and raised himself. Giving of oneself, there's that message of generosity again, is so important. You give of something that has meaning and importance for you. And so take a look on your sheet, please. Look at this criticism from the prophet Malachi. He says, he's speaking to the Jews, about bringing defective offerings. And he says, bring it to your human ruler. Would he be satisfied? Would he show favor to you? What you have to bring is something that has value and importance to you. And there's more on this in Maimonides in number 18, which you can look at later. But the message that I'm trying to show here from the Midrash is if somebody doesn't respect the animal, they can't bring it as a gift to God. If he doesn't respect it, he also can't give it to God, because it's all about respect. That's the second message of the Midrash. He failed in feeding the lion, therefore, he can't bring a gift to God. And then there's a third message, which I think is as important, if not more important, than the first two. First one is feed your animals. Second one is the attitude of the korban. But the third one is that God is really demanding. If you take a look at source number 20, this is a good, concise statement of it. God is precise with those who surround him to the width of a hair. It's learned from the local verse. But it means you don't get away with anything because you've been righteous. The fact that a person has done good things, the fact that a person is, so to speak, close to God, doesn't spare them from punishment if they do something wrong. There is no favoritism. You can't claim special status. So even Noah, who was described as being righteous, perfect in his generations, walked with God, God doesn't play favorites. If you skimp on what you're giving to the lion, you're slow in what you give to the lion, you will be paid back. That is the third message here. So what we get here is, as I hope we followed in the first half, a midrash that is reading notes within the text, like the use of the word tzaddik, like the fruit of the righteous being a tree of life, and so on, and drawing a lesson from there to explain Proverbs by association with Noah, but it's teaching us three really important lessons. The importance of the mercy of the human being for animals. We feed the animals first. The attitude of the korban. You have to be giving something that is meaningful to you. Like Hevel brings his, Abel brings his animals, which he has raised. And if Noah doesn't treat the animal with proper respect, then he can't bring it as a gift to God. And number three, that God doesn't cut anybody slack if they're close to God. You have to... everybody is held to a standard, and they are held to an even higher standard. All of these are important, and I go back now, just to conclude on a better note, on a more positive note, to the first point that we made back in the beginning, which is that the fruit of the righteous is what they provide for others. Right? It's good to have children. It's good to have wonderful children. We should all be blessed with wonderful children. But the way that we are gauged, the demonstration of who a person is what they provide for those around them to be, as Noah was, somebody who is Ish Tzadik, a righteous person who provides a tree of life for others. Thank you very much.